Bring in David Terachuk. It is the Media Beat. Of course, David joins us on a Friday morning live. We broadcast David on the weekend, also during the noontime hour on our news break Monday. And also, you can find David at his own website, themediabeat.us. He is also a contributor at the Huffington Post, and he also is a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. Good morning, David.
Well, hello. It's good to be with you from the media capital of the world, New York City. Here I am.
Well, and here we are. Now, of course, we could talk Brexit, but obviously we could talk Brexit to the end of time.
We can always talk Brexit, Marshall.
It's the longest exit I've ever seen that might not actually turn out to be an exit.
Waving your straw voter as you go off to the left of the stage.
It's amazing.
Goodbye.
Before we get there, though, I have to ask you about this is what I think is wrong with the United States right now. By declaring that the Golan Heights is officially part of Israel, the United States is not the great emperor of the world and can declare land transfers. And what's interesting about that, the minute I heard that yesterday, my father had an expression that he used to say to us when we were running the house, making a lot of noise, and my mother was not feeling well, and he would say, "Let sleeping dogs lie." When you know, if the dog doesn't know that you're, it can't get upset. Everybody really had forgotten. But the Golan Heights was just a past tense issue that's been on everybody's table of, okay, that'll be part of a possible peace settlement. Now it takes it off that, and really, it's another thing that will agitate the opponents of Israel.
Sure, anything that draws attention to what has been a glaring piece of illegal land seizure is not helpful if you really are interested in a peace settlement, finally, because, of course, the Israelis seized that overlook territory. Golan Heights isn't called Golan Heights for nothing. It looks down from a very strategically advantageous position on Israel, and of course Israel wanted to get it for its very clear defensive capacity. And if you don't achieve a settlement to the long-running conflict, it's there as a at the worst a constant outrage to the Palestinian side of the argument, and in particular the Syrian side of the argument, because of course it was constitutionally speaking it was Syrian territory before the Israelis seized it. It's always there at its worst as a threat, or at its minimum, and possibly even helpfully, as a bargaining chip for future negotiations. Now, of course, rather like the transfer of the American embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, and it's now a contentious notion again, and drawing attention to it from the highest level, from the White House in the United States, of course, you're putting a glaring light on it and making it a lot less easy to use as a bargaining chip, and of course emphasize very much again its position as a glaring outrage of international illegality.
Yeah, it's one of those things that you look back at, you look back at the wars that Israel had had to fight to survive. They had to. There was no ifs, ands, or ups about it. But the world has changed. The weapons have changed so much. And it's far more dangerous, but it's also far easier for Palestinians or irritants, people that oppose Israel, to strike it in many different ways. But it's one of those things that once again, it appears that Donald Trump did not really talk to anybody in the State Department about that tweet.
Nothing new about that. Constantly tweeting, as I know from my very close study at the Donald J. Trump Presidential Library, which I visited in Austin, Texas, a couple of weeks ago, as you'll recall, part of the South by Southwest festivals. Yeah, it's international relations conducted by tweet. Not the best way of ensuring delicate movement. The last thing it is delicate, of course. And that's your point, I suppose, merely by drawing attention to it with the light of the White House searchlight upon it, you know that this is going to become a problem, even if it's not been a problem for some time.
Considering that Pompeo was over there, and considering that this is election, and considering that as far as, I mean, last I knew, tweets didn't... what did the tweet actually say?
Now you have me. I'm not going to be able to quote it directly, but it clearly put the position of the President of the United States firmly on the side of the Israelis when it came to the issue of the Golan Heights, which of course is a you know, technically speaking and internationally speaking, it is a pending issue. And he elevated it, of course, to a, you know, let's make a declaration type of issue.
The tweet basically now said America recognized the Golan Heights as Israeli territory. That's what the tweet basically.
Did it say it had, or that it is time to do that, or what?
No, it does.
It recognizes. It was the present tense. Yeah,
it was the present tense.
And now, does that mean recognizes de facto or recognizes the legality of it? It's not clear because Trump's tweets are not instruments of policy, although the swagger with which they're written suggests that that's how we are supposed to take them.
The only reason that I'm even mentioning this is because I strongly encourage everybody to, when they hear something, just question it. That's really the only reason.
Oh, well, of course, yes, right. And of course, if it comes from the tweeter in chief, question it even more closely. I mean, you're absolutely right.
The tweet was: the United States recognizes the Golan Heights as Israeli territory because it's of critical strategic and security importance to the state of Israel and regional stability. That was the tweet.
Okay, and when is this election?
Soon.
Because I was also fascinated.
Whole thing about words like that, about tweets, and with Donald Trump, unfortunately, tweets are a position of the president. But the unfortunate part about tweets...
Well, anything the president says is a position of the president. Yeah. I mean, that's the conundrum we face.
And the problem with a tweet like that is that it's out there, and it now takes something which nobody really wanted to touch, because the Golan Heights wasn't on anybody's big hit list. But it becomes an irritant once again to all the states surrounding Israel, and once again it's like picking at an old wound. You know, you open it up.
But well, again, having since drat, they didn't invite me. So I wasn't there, and I wasn't in any of the proceedings prior to. So I have one of the things that I've noticed watching over the last few years is that these things they may appear to come out of left field, but there's just a heck of a lot of pre-discussion. So.
There's no pre-discussion on Trump tweets. There's no pre-discussion on Trump tweets.
Okay. So I would like to talk about David's favorite place for a second. Because
what's my favorite place?
Africa.
South by Southwest. You want to talk about South by Southwest?
No, I want to talk about Africa and how there was a massive cyclone there
in Southern Africa was going
that got about as much attention as the retraction column.
Sure. Yeah. It's a vast. We call it a cyclone because it comes from the Indian Ocean, and that's the term that's used there. But it's essentially, imagine a vast hurricane running through the southern states of America, the United States of America, or indeed anywhere in our hemisphere, And that's what you see in Africa. It's not a very common occurrence. And the three main countries, Mozambique, which is right on the coast, and Malawi and Zimbabwe, which are towards the hinterland, further into the continent of Africa, have been battered hellishly. And as if they didn't have enough to cope with, Zimbabwe in particular, with its governance and in complete turmoil now since Mugabe, the dictator for decades, was ousted and has been replaced by a man who's beginning to emulate his predecessor. Not only is that political turmoil already in place and already causing enough concern about Zimbabwe's future, but now they have this natural disaster to cope with too. It seems like sometimes that corner of the world just can't get a break.
And how did the coverage of it compare to the usual?
Well, thin, I think, is the kind word to say about it.
But typically thin.
The coverage in the West is what you mean, of course. I mean, coverage in Africa was gigantic, of course, because it was one of the biggest natural disasters that befallen that southern part of the continent for God knows how long.
Well, never mind the cyclone in Africa not being covered. The disaster in the Midwest of this country in Nebraska is just starting to be covered a week after it hit. And this is a region which has been affected by the tariffs that Donald Trump put on. That was blow number one. And then, you know, people forget Nebraska. Oh, that's a state in the middle. It has the most rivers of any state in the United States. All of them flooded at once. And once again, now the heartland is taking just a massive hit. And yes, you've seen a little bit on the news lately, but that's a week after it happened. I mean, it's absolutely amazing how these two stories don't lead the news story coverages.
Sure. I mean, although we do joke every week about my being stationed in the media capital of the world, New York City, the truth is American media take their cue not so much from anything in New York, although obviously our filter is set to this metropolitan center. But the herd mentality that determines what, generally speaking, and most broadly gets covered by the nation's media is set in Washington. And our politics are so febrile at the moment that they lead the top of every agenda for just about every screen you might look at, every publication, every radio broadcast. Washington is always the heart and the center of the agenda. And of course, Nebraska is almost as far from Washington as Mozambique is.
Yeah. In terms of people's interest.
That's been happening here, of course.
Yeah, and that's, you know, again, not, this is just to say, oh, hey, you know, people, it's helpful to, it might not be the most interesting thing, but there are other things going on.
It's not the most sort of agitating and febrile and related to the outrage of yesterday, which is what overall qualifies stuff for getting into the lead position now. Does it relate to our current concerns? Well, both of them came out of, well, at least the latest twists, and a cyclonic twist, it certainly was in Africa's case. They certainly came out of the blue. And Nebraska's latest turn of bad fortune came from natural or so-called natural beginnings. So when things happen unexpectedly, it seems to take the great beast, the great leviathan of American media, a little time to register that it might be important.
Well, and who's that down to?
Editors, of course, banks of editors. And you know, most of all, it's a psychological thing. It's the herd mentality I referred to a moment ago. If it's already on our minds, then something that happens today that relates to what's already on our minds is bound to take precedence over something that's brand new and seems distant. You know, there's nothing like the idea of something happening on another continent for it automatically not to have anything like the weight of something happening close by. And indeed, if it happens deep in the Midwest, the political editors in Washington can still point to the agitation of Washington at the moment as a justification for their latest political story to get precedence over any natural disaster in a foreign or a distant American location.
You know, what the main problem is that all the what we became used to, people of our age, dinosaurs that are roaming the earth still, we were used to newsrooms and networks having coverage because they had bureaus all over the place. Even if it included just one person in that bureau, there was a...
But now you can do it yourself.
I know for a fact that NBC at one point had reporters specifically stationed in the Southwest, the West, the Heartland, the Northeast, and in Florida, just regional. They were always there, and it was their beat to cover stories.
They were called correspondents
in that area. Very little of that goes on now, and you were there were familiar voices that came from those areas. That doesn't happen now.
And you knew that they had expertise, and yeah. You also got the very clear impression, justifiably, that they carried some weight with the newsroom at the pinnacle of this whole operation. They would be listened to within their own organization because they did have the expertise that they had, and that is what has gone as well.
And they also had, like, if you go back to Watergate and you look at the work that was done on Watergate, well, guess what? The Washington Post and the New York Times had plenty of other reporters that could work on other stories at the time. And that's another thing that
well,
people don't
thing,
realize but- is that the actual pruning of the employees at these news organizations it really does affect what they can cover.
But there's also the manipulation of mind control. Is that you've told everybody just pay attention to the headlines, and the headlines are the very same. And, you know, because people need a constant injection of a 5-hour energy drink, you know, the headlines are, you just have to keep banging away. And no, you said don't bother clicking. I've said this a million times. I cannot tell you the number of non-dinosaurs who have said, oh, I just read the headline on my, you know, my feed. I get to select them. That's great.
Yeah, I've selected them. I've pre-selected them.
Yeah, exactly. What are you interested in?
It's for what I'm interested in.
Yeah.
Yeah, and sure. And eventually that feeds into the decision maker's own, what is left, at least, of the human element in this decision-making process at the pinnacle of the media organization concerned. So that the blind, what you know, I think of as the blinder or blinkers, horse blinkers effect is reinforced. People only get to hear about what they have said in advance that they are interested in, and that begins to influence what the processors and the output people are supplying. And then you're in this vicious cycle of never getting out of the same topics or variants on the same topics being our diet all the time.
And with all of these diets that are customized, they tend to fall away from the whole contextual, well, this is a body and a little bit of balance is never hurt anybody.
You know, also,
the diet needs variety. You're right.
With today's modern technology, I'm even more astounded because back in the days when television would cover things and they would have correspondents all over the place, it was not unheard of to have the anchor sit there and have the correspondent call in on a telephone and give a clear and concise report, even on TV. And that's the main thing why I think radio will never ever go away, is that radio can very instantly, if it wants to, produce live content from anywhere very quickly to keep people updated.
Oh, sure. You'll never get an argument with me about the greater flexibility of radio as a medium. It's head and shoulders above every other one. Because I mean, perhaps with the possible exception word of mouth, by any means. You know, if you can write a postcard, you can write a very fast email, and of course the email arrives immediately. And you know, there's nothing wrong with someone just reading on air a flash that has come from their correspondent in a distant realm. But if it's someone that they know, they trust, and the listeners or viewers trust as well, then that essential job of information passage, that passing on of information, is being done at its simplest and most direct, and usually very, very quickly too.
I can just put it this way, David, that the it seems like at the networks, the managing editors follow the trends on social media, and those are the stories that we see. And unfortunately, social media, once again, is our people who are posting from sites that they only go to. And so it's a skewed metric. You know, I bring back to when Brad Field, a meteorologist for 30 years at WVIT, resigned suddenly last summer, and I just knew something was up. Yeah, it was up. Someone young came in to manage the news department and said, well, this guy's salary, he's been here too long, we'll get rid of him. Hey, let's put a brand new truck that has radar and stuff on the road so people can...
Drive around in the truck. We can take pictures of them driving around in the truck.
And so then they brought the youngest meteorologist up. They named him the chief meteorologist, and they got rid of someone with 30 years of experience in forecasting the weather.
Leave the old people. It's just there is something to be said for experience that your computers cannot.
We spend an awful lot of time amassing that experience. Yeah.
There's something to be said, of course,
experience is drawn in so many different ways at the moment. What you were talking about a second ago, about how social media has become a determinant. I mean, the interesting thing is that social media are, of course, and I don't think any level-headed journalist would ever dispute this, are a very valuable source for newsrooms now. But it's become much more than a source, which has to be, of course, cross-checked against other sources. It's become very much a determinant of that agenda. What is trending? Oh, well, in that case, if this is trending, then this must be followed up, usually at the expense of something else that might have been more deserving of our attention.
And also the thing that is the progress and the transition of personnel in a newsroom and in media in general. There used to be people coming on and training under people with experience, and then those people trained after they trained for like 5 or 10 years. They then moved into that position because they saw how it doesn't work that way nowadays.
Yeah, now you come and sit down, and this is true of investment, so many other things. You come and sit down, and you know, your expectation is that you can do it. And the thing is, you might be able to do the top line stuff. It's just all that underneath nuts and bolts that you don't have any clue about. And you don't even know, this is the worst of all, don't even know what you don't know. So,
well, it was over there, I think, but it's made worse, I think, by the fact that it is also amplified, and you get the blinker effect happening right across the board, with, you know, one or two brave exceptions here and there, but the vast majority of the media at the national level are all so much in lockstep now. The herd mentality is very hard to contradict.
All right. And when we resume next week, we'll see if Brexit is still on the table.
It will.
I think you'll find it's still there.
I was just going to say the same thing.
We've got an extra few weeks after all the latest negotiations. But, of course, all that means is the can is well and truly kicked down the road just a little.
And all I want to know as we end this show is who coined the phrase meaningful vote?
It has such wonderful implications. I mean, in Parliament, this will be a meaningful vote as opposed to the thousands of votes taken.
Pointless ones, right?
All right, David, we'll speak to you next week.
I look forward to that.
Take care. David Terechuk with the Media Beat here on Robinhood Radio. You'll also find him at robinhoodradio.com. Click on demand, the Media Beat, and at his own page, themediabeat.us.